should really just start with, and I would advise that you start with an ETF because it's simple, it's easy to understand, and you get a nice mix of diversification.
Welcome to the My Money, My Lifestyle podcast, where we discuss all things money, because whether or not we like it, money matters. Now, as humans, we're quite voyeuristic. We love to know what other people are getting up to, which is why social media is so compulsive. And this is equally true about other people's money. We really want to know how other people spend their money and how they invest it. This has created a whole genre on social media of money bloggers, people who share their experiences around money. They don't claim to be experts, but in sharing their views, they start conversations. And one of these is Brett, who writes a blog called ETF Enthusiast, where he openly shares his investment decisions and the reason why he invests as he does. He writes about how he's planning his investments to provide a passive income one day. And I thought this would be a great conversation for this podcast. So welcome, Brett, and welcome onto the My Money, My Lifestyle podcast.
No, it's a pleasure. Yeah. No, it's my first official podcast recording. So yeah, nervous and excited at the same time. But thanks for having me.
Well, Brett, you're just talking about yourself, which is always the easiest thing to talk about. So that's absolutely fine. Well, I don't know. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's the hard part to talk about yourself. But yeah. Brett, just quickly, this is not your full-time job. You have a blog, talk a little bit about what it's like, why you decided to do this. Why are you blogging and having a column and doing all these things about your money? What brought you to this space?
I think it started with friends, sort of comparing what they were doing with their money. A friend said, you know, my dad and me started looking at investments and made me feel a bit like I'm missing out. Started also with the uncle sharing his investment portfolio with me and saying, what am I doing, you know, to make sure that I have, you know, in a better position one day. So that's kind of where it started. And then that sparked an interest in me, you know, outside of social connections, to go and read and research myself. And yeah, from there, it just became really a passion. And I was doing it at a stage when I started where the conversation in this country online was, you know, it was very institutional. It wasn't necessarily a lot from individuals' perspectives. So I tried my hand at writing very badly, I must say, for many years. I still do it very badly, but I've at least gotten a little bit better. And yeah, I just share my own approach, my own journey. And yeah, it's really just continue to evolve from that passion.
Do you find that it reinforces your discipline? So if you've set out this plan and you're sharing this plan with everybody, do you feel like that kind of holds you accountable? Is it kind of a peer accountability mechanism as well?
Yeah, no, it definitely is. And it helps you refine your own ideas because something can sometimes make sense in your head, but then the next month or the next week, you feel slightly different. So, you know, once you think about it and you write it down and you put it out there, it really helps you reinforce the ideas and you know, build them at a level in your mind that becomes more it becomes more established as a long-term strategy or goal. So it's actually something I encourage everyone to do, which is, you know, even if you're not writing on the internet, to write down their approaches and what it means in their own situation, so that you have a level of commitment to these ideas for a long period of time. These things do change and my approaches do change, but ever increasingly they change less frequently, over the long term. So,
And do you find you get feedback? So when you do a post or you do a tweet or anything like that, people give you kind of input. Have you ever found like that's been kind of like, oh, okay, I've changed my mind because I've had somebody responding? Or
Yeah. You get used to different types of feedback. So there's the feedback that's just like quite flippant and like you would be silly to do that. But you get used to that and you kind of take it for what it is and just look into what they're talking about. But then you get the really good feedback that that I've had many times and had to change my approaches to things many times. From people that I more often, try to cling to their ideas, know what they're thinking and what they're doing. I think there's a lot of that in money and investing and finance. You look to others to establish your own ideas first. And I've definitely got that a lot from my blog, and definitely a lot from whether it be Twitter or other blogs. It's a big part of how I, feel about my own strategy today. Mm.
It feels to me like it's this virtual investment club almost, isn't it? I mean, in the sense of it is this kind of peer thing where you can share ideas. And I think it's been incredibly powerful. I mean, obviously there's dangers to it because you're very clear, this is not advice. And I think that's very important to say this works for me for these reasons. And one has to be very careful about generalizing. But, there are some golden rules and golden threads that run through it. And Brett, I just want to put up there, first of all, you're married, you've just got a little girl, so congratulations on that. You save a significant amount of your income. Just tell the listeners how much you save every month.
Yeah, so it was quite consistently over the last, and I've been tracking it quite religiously for about 6 years now. I'm now 29, almost 30. So since I sort of entered the workplace, I started tracking, what I spend and what I earn, and what I save. And I got, consistently about 40% of my total income goes towards savings and investing. I must say it's creeping down this year because of having a daughter. I think the principle is just as my income has moved, not only have I have used it to improve my standard of living, that's for sure, and I will continue to do that, but the proportion that I do save and invest, which is a big part of how I, want to live my life in the future, that's remained fairly consistent. So I can at least feel very happy for where I've come from and what I have accomplished today.
I mean, absolutely. And I think we always say to people, if you get into the discipline of saving a high percentage of your salary right from the beginning, then that's just part of the budget. It's not something that, it's very hard 20 years in to suddenly, or even 10 years in, to suddenly say, I'm going to take 40% of my salary away, effectively, which, of my spending away. So the fact that you've done it so early on and developed it is absolutely phenomenal. But what do you think that you have to, and I'm using the word sacrifice with inverted commas, because I think we mustn't be in this mindset that we're giving up stuff. We're building towards a future. We're building towards something that we really believe in and is going to give us financial freedom. But what are the things that you kind of don't do that you see people who are saving less do? Let's put it that way.
Look, I think a lot of it comes down to priorities, and understanding yourself and what makes you happy. I know if my wife had it her way, we probably would go on weekends away every other week. So I mean, if there's one aspect, it's probably that. And I probably do pull her back slightly and say, like, let's plan them out for the year. There are still some spontaneous ones, but I think overall, like, it's just how I've prioritized what I do spend on. And I do spend money. I spend, still quite a lot on restaurants. I go out and enjoy myself quite a lot with that. We're going to Lac Alom this Sunday, which is a very fancy restaurant here in Cape Town. So yeah, there's room for that, and definitely it's on the experience side that I enjoy spending money for. But on the physical possession side, I've probably not chased much there. I don't have. I had a Honda Ballard from the age of 20, which I sort of funded with 40,000 rand through tennis coaching, and I had that car for almost 10 years. I sold it. I just got a new car last year, so I had that Honda Ballard for.
And did you finance the car?
No, 40,000 rand cash. I was lucky to find it. And then I was in a good position last year to also have built up enough savings to not have to finance it. So,
you know, Brett, that's something I do as well. I only buy with cash. So I hold on to my cars for 10, 12 years, and then I've built up enough cash to, again, do it in cash because of the thought of paying finance on a car. And I'm always shocked. I'm always shocked when I see the amount of money that people land up paying on financing. And it's an incredibly expensive thing to have. So, yeah, I'm with you on that one. I think my very first car was financed. But then I haven't ever since then had car finance, so which is a really great plus. But I want to get onto your investing. So you're obviously able to put away 40% of your income, or have it been until the baby was born. And just by the way, Brett, that's the whole important thing. That's the one thing I can get through to younger people, and I didn't do enough of it. It's before the mortgage and the children and all of that, you have a lot more disposable income. Trust me, when the kids arrive, that disposable income is you want to be doing this before the kids arrive, okay? So that's the key thing. But where do you just talk a little bit about your investment strategy, because it is on your blog, and I find it very, very interesting the way you've diversified, but also how you are planning on turning that into an income stream for you later on. Because a lot of people think, when they think income stream, they think, I must have a rental property. They don't realize that you can do that through investing in shares and even exchange traded funds.
Yeah, so I think that's definitely the priority for me within my investing strategy, is exchange traded funds. And it's mainly because of research I've done and the research that's available in the market that really shows that not only is it the simplest way, but most of the time it's the most effective way to perform ahead of or perform in line with how the market performs and ahead of much of the competition that you see in the financial markets. So that's definitely been the priority and the bedrock of my investing strategy, and why my blog is called ETF Enthusiast, because I think it's something that should be part of everyone's portfolio. Definitely my first money goes into a tax-free savings account every month, and I've narrowed it down to really just buying one ETF now that's well diversified, and that's global, and that's low cost, and I've become confident enough in it to not seek a lot of other things with my money, less excitement that, I feel like missing out on a Bitcoin trend or missing out here or there on the latest fads that you hear every other week. So that's definitely the first priority. And that in the future is I do plan for that to fund most of my living expenses. Most of that become from dividend income. And then there'll also be a portion where you can sell some of that assets off eventually. Obviously being part of a company, I do have a retirement fund. So that's obviously a necessary evil, let's call it, because it's quite strict. But it does have some tax advantages. So with that, that's probably going to be with me for some time, because I am working for a company, and that eventually will turn one day into either a guaranteed or a living annuity that will fund an income for me. And then I do have an investment property. I bought it very early on, probably when I couldn't actually afford it. But obviously it's become more affordable for me over time as my income increased. And I think I've gotten quite lucky with it. I don't think it's always the best investment. You can often overpay and underperform on returns and have a very costly situation when it comes to properties. But I do think I've gotten fairly lucky with it, and I've managed it fairly well, and I haven't had to put much money in. So it is still, and I would like to keep it because the yield of income return monthly compared to some of my other sort of investments is, you know, it's still something that can form a small portion of my income one day in retirement. So I do own that. And I think those are probably the big three of how I intend to fund myself one day when I no longer want to work. But the big one being dividends. And that's the priority.
Yeah, and I think for me, that's my dividends are my big strategy. I actually invest my money in and even my retirement annuity is invested in dividend yielding investments because I want to one day only draw my dividends and not touch the capital. And I think it's something that is so misunderstood in investments. Everybody talks about the capital return. And I saw it work so well with my mom. You know, I worked for a stockbroking firm. And at the time, we invested my mom's money in a dividend portfolio. And, you know, she's gone through the ups and downs of the 2008 crash, the COVID crash, this, you name the crashes she's been through. And she keeps saying to me, but Maya, I don't understand why I'm still getting this income that goes up every year. And that's because it's a dividend portfolio. So, you know, as long as the companies, you know, there was a little bit of blip, obviously, with COVID, where some of the banks didn't pay dividends for a short period. But even now, they're really paying them again. So your risk there is so much lower than relying on selling capital. You know, if you had to pull out of your living annuity capital in March 2020, you would have been in big trouble. So, I try and talk about it a lot, but people just, it seems to be something nobody really wants to talk about because it's not sexy. It's a lot more sexy to talk about the NASPAS share price or Bitcoin, all of these things. Yeah. And that's what I have, the problem I have with Bitcoin as well. It's just this volatile share price. You're just betting on, or not even share price, asset price. You're just betting on this price. You know, for me, I want to know that I'm going to develop an income stream from it. So I think you and I are quite aligned on that. And of course, investment property has, I think it is, it has a place. I'm not crazy about it because I couldn't be bothered with tenants. So that's why I'm not sitting in property. But, it, you know, you've got a really well diversified portfolio there. And your in terms of your one day when you're not going to work, I mean, do you have a financial freedom idea? So that doesn't mean you're going to stop working. It just means you're going to reach a point where your income could cover your expenses.
Yes.
How far away are you from that?
I do track it sort of as a number that I do need to get to in order to reach these goals. I am about, let's call it quite far away, about 20% there. But it is an exponential curve. So, you know, a lot of the work needs to be done now and you won't make much progress on that number. But because of compound interest, you will make a lot of ground, in a decade or, you know, in the final few years of the strategy. So I think I'm comfortable where I'm at. You know, it's not always easy to see other people doing crazy capital growth and all that, and you feel like, okay, sure, maybe I'm missing out, but I've become confident and happy with where I'm at, and I think, yeah, if I carry on going, I will definitely reach the goals.
But I mean, that compounding is so unbelievably powerful. I mean, if you're just running a 10% return per annum over long term, it's doubling every 7 years. So, you know, when you get to your first million, that means in 7 years, it's 2 million, then it's 4 million, then it's 8 million. So that compounding difference between the millions starts growing and growing and growing. So, you know, I was explaining this the other day. I said, you know, everyone says, oh, you know, most people at the age of 30 have about 100,000 rand sitting in their pension funds, right? And that's when they cash it in because it looks 100,000 rand. It's not a lot of investment money, but it can sort out my debts, right? The market bounce back. The market now gives you, say, a 15% return that year. You're 10,000 Rand, 15, you get 15,000 Rand back, and you're thinking, well, you know, not so. What if it's a million? That million gives you 150,000 Rand back for the same market in the same investments, identical. And you don't realize it unless you keep that 100,000 and keep growing it, it's never going to get to the million. And it's only when you start getting into the millions that you start to see that incredible power of compounding and growth and all the rest of it. So I think that is, and that's a very hard message I find for people to get through to younger people, because there's so much more to spend money on.
Yes. Yeah, and I think a lot of people, they understand what it means to have compound interest, but there's the experience is definitely lacking in seeing it play out practically. So that's why you'll find a lot of people that are new to this, you know, money moves around like it's water from one thing to another. And it takes a couple of years, you know, to start having that confidence that, okay, no, it needs to stay put if I'm actually going to make it. But for some, it doesn't. Some, it never sticks. And money just moves around. And you know, the more levers you're pulling, the more you're probably damaging your own returns and compound interest benefits over time.
Well, you're probably at a point where if you even stopped contributing, compounding will start doing quite a lot of work for you. So your baby and all the rest of it, you don't have to be beating yourself up too much because you've done the right thing. You're using time to catch it up instead of the contributions. But I wanted to ask you, you know, a lot of people, whenever I do a podcast or an article on ETFs or anything, they say, where do I start? So what do you say? Well, if somebody's just like, I want to start, I'm listening to this, I want to begin, how do I choose? And I think for me, the irritation is that when exchange traded funds first came out, and let me tell you, I was probably one of the first investors in 2002. Okay, I invested. Yeah. So some people weren't even born then. But they proliferated. So there's almost too much choice. You go onto the Satrix website and you feel like a little bit daunted by the choice now. I mean, how would you, how do you go about it?
Yeah, I think there's no easy answer. I think that everyone has to start. So where do you start is always, you know, tricky. Do you just buy the most simple? I mean, like, I know what I would do, which now in hindsight, which was buy the simplest, most broad, which is most holding the most companies, and cheapest ETF I can find. And just stick to that. So that's, you know, in hindsight, but I didn't start that way. The way I started was messier. You know, I bought the Satrix 40 and then the Equal Weight 40 because, you know, of some methodology differences that I thought might be beneficial, which ended up not being. And then I moved it to the Indie, and then I moved, you know what I mean? So it's messy. I always just think start simple and start with something you understand, like the Satrix 40, and then build your own investment philosophy from there. You can look at what I invest in and you can copy me, and then you can do the same and figure out what works for you. I think it's a difficult one that's quite personal. But opening an account and getting money in an ETF, that's 80% of the battle. And then 20% of the battle is just sticking with your decision. Most people don't even get there. So I think that's the most important thing.
As long as the money's going into something. Although I would strongly avoid any very single asset or high concentration risk like property, for example. So we saw a lot of the ETF property ETFs were very popular. Before the great crash and property market crash in 2008. And then again, property was again hit in 2020. So you've got, you know, property is one of those ones that I think I agree with you. I think good diversification and not trying to guess the second next best trend. And I was smiling a bit when you said, you know, the new fancy valuation techniques come out. So I had Raffi. I took out the Satrix Raffi exactly for that reason. And it frigging laggard everybody, all the other things for a while. And then I was looking at my portfolio thinking, I just need to just consolidate a bit. And I saw the Raffi's actually done really, really well. recently. So maybe it's not so bad to have a little bit of diversification within there. But yeah, I agree with you. And you know, also for me, I have a retirement annuity. I do believe in them. I know I've done the numbers, and there's a lot of other things like estate duty and creditor protection and all the rest of it for me.
Yeah.
But because of that, I'm heavily weighted offshore for my discretionary funds because I'm limited in South Africa. So, you know, you also need to look at your situation. And I'm not a big fan of saying have no South Africa in your thing, because boy, have you been hurt this year. We're one of the best performing stock markets in the world. And I've got all the analysis to show that actually a good blend of them, and like it is, diversification really, really works.
I think for me, I would want to be weighted more international than South Africa. Personally, probably 70-30 or 80-20 to international. And that's mainly because I want my assets to hold value with, you know, world currencies. And often when you invest internationally, you're investing not only in the assets that are listed offshore, but it's also in that currency. So I want to travel. I probably want to live overseas as well and work overseas. So that probably increases my bias to want to have higher offshore weightings for that reason. But yeah, it's everyone's, and you only develop that understanding, you know, as you go. So it's impossible to get it all right first time.
Yeah, I mean, I sit actually with my offshore holdings are offshore, as they're not even South African. So, you know, and for that reason as well, I want to have diversification. I want to have risk diversification. I want to have all of those things. So I think you need to look at your personal situation and make a decision from there. But, you know, I must just tell you, I was pulling some graphs, and over the last 18 years, the JSE has outperformed the MSCI in rands. So it's only in the last 12 years, if you look, and that was literally a short period of about 4 years where we underperformed quite significantly. So again, this argument that, you know, people forget things go up and down and they move in roundabouts. So yeah, again, we keep coming back to this word diversification. So
yeah.
Great. But Brett, I just want to say thank you so much for coming on. But are there any kind of like last tips that you would like to give listeners who are just, you know, wanting to get in there, who want to save 40% of their salary to one day have financial freedom?
No, I think the most important thing is to get started with some sort of investment. You should really just start with, and I would advise that you start with an ETF because it's simple, it's easy to understand, and you get a nice mix of diversification in risk in a sort of not the most risky field that you could put your money. Like if I think of some of the other things that are around today, it's good consistent performance over the long term. So I really think that, you know, just starting is half the battle, and I think that's probably the key message that I would give.
And that monthly debit order, rand cost averaging, you know, just you know, not having to try and second guess the market. Is it up? Is it down? Is now a good time to put my money in? If you're just putting the debit order in every month, it's going to work out.
And also, I think comparisons to others, like you can look at my 40% number or my 20% of my goals achieved, and it can motivate some, but it also can make some people feel, you know, I'm behind. And I think that's, we all feel that at some stage when we look at what other people are doing and what they're achieving. But I think looking at where you are today as your own point of reference, and not, you know, not that's got to be your measurement for success, and not others. I mean, the world is so unequitable as it is that we can't get hung up on how others are doing compared to ourselves. So I think find some acceptance of where you are today and use that as a measure for your own success going forward. I think that's an important lesson.
I think that's a brilliant point, Brett, because everybody has different precious family issues, family they need to support. Not everybody's in the same position. But I think the bottom line is that, you know, you need to be putting some money away. So just start. That's probably it.
Yeah.
Just start.
Just start.
So great. Well, thank you so much, Brett. And I'm going to be keeping an eye on your blog. And we will put the handle, but it is ETF Enthusiast. You can find him on Twitter. And the website is also, it's etfenthusiast.co.za. You've been listening to the My Money, My Lifestyle podcast, featuring the contributors of the City Press Personal Finance Pages.